The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
We want to be innovative. We want to have better and better products and services, more products, different products, and so on. The problem is that when you're in the business of trying to innovate a new product or service, your focus, understandably, is trying to get the service or product to work. And anything that you do that takes away from that goal delays you. There's a time to market issue. And since the first guy in a particular space is often the most successful, there's a high pressure to go fast. So, and nobody has yet figured out how to build security into a product and do it fast at the same time.
I'm Wells Bennett, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 17th, 2014. You just heard the voice of Herb Lin. He's chief scientist at the Computer Science and Telecommunications Board, itself a unit of the National Research Council at the National Academies. Lin's expertise is broad and deep and extends, among many other things, to cyber matters. In particular, he's helped to edit a recently issued report entitled At the Nexus of Public Policy and Cybersecurity. Lin thus sat down this week with our own Ben Wittes, both to discuss the piece and options for domestic cyber policy. Their discussion is notable for many reasons. One was Lin's view that, in essence, the United States has become well acquainted with the trade-offs implicated by cyber risks and the growth of technology. Indeed, he says, the policy world is paying more and more attention to the issue these days, and that's to the good. But for all that, Lin also says, our society hasn't yet shown a genuine willingness to address the difficult dilemmas surrounding cybersecurity. You'll hear all about that and more in the Lawfare Podcast, Episode 75, A Conversation with Herb Lin on Cybersecurity.
So you've got a new report. Tell us about it.
Okay. The National Academies has just released a report, which is essentially a primer on cybersecurity. The title of it is At the Nexus of Public Policy and Cybersecurity, or maybe it's the other way around. And it's intended to be a primer for people who want to understand fundamental cybersecurity issues that affect and are relevant to public policy. The report goes through an explanation of why information technology is critical to the economy and to our daily life. That's old hat by now. It goes through a description of what the fundamentals are of information technology that make it fundamentally hard to secure. I'll come back to that in a minute. It takes a little bit of time describing the kinds of threats that we face and the kinds of goes through the anatomy of a cybersecurity breach, what that might be about. Tells you a little bit about the various things you can do about it. By you, I mean the nation, and which are there are a variety of techniques there. And it talks about some of the conflicts that we face in trying to deal with cybersecurity as a public policy issue. One asks the question, if in fact cybersecurity is so important to the nation, why haven't we done something about it? Well, the short answer is because we value cybersecurity, but we value other things too, and often those things come into conflict.
And what are the things, in your judgment, that we value more than cybersecurity to the point that we don't actually end up getting a lot of cybersecurity done as a policy matter?
I'll give you one example. I don't know whether these are the biggest, but one example. is that paying attention to cybersecurity conflicts with the needs of, or with our needs to undergo innovation in new products and like, undergo is the wrong word. But we want to be innovative. We want to have better and better products and services, more products, different products, and so on. The problem is that when you're in the business of trying to innovate a new product or service, your focus, understandably, is trying to get the service or product to work. And anything that you do that takes away from that goal delays you. There's a time to market issue. And since the first guy in a particular space is often the most successful, there's a high pressure to go fast. So, and nobody has yet figured out how to build security into a product and do it fast at the same time.
Is that an irresolvable problem? Or, part of me says, well, we have decided to get products before they're actually ready. And we want products more than we want to wait for them to be actually ready, and we want them for less money than they actually cost. And so what we're getting is sort of 70 to 80% of the actual product, which is to say the product minus the things that would secure it. We're not paying for the security. And so it would be like, you know, everybody buying houses without locks on their doors, because you can get the house earlier if you just don't wait to put the lock on it. Is that what's going on, or is the problem actually more fundamental than that, and that there's some reason why you couldn't wait until products are ready to be delivered securely before marketing them?
If you had an economy in which products were never marketed before somebody deemed them ready to be marketed, by someone I mean some, for example, government authority, to say this product is secure or is adequately secure or at least has paid some attention to security, then perhaps you could do it. I don't know anybody who wants to live in that world.
Or if there were adequate liability for the damage that you cause when you bring a product to market whose inattention to security then causes people damage, right? It doesn't have to be a preemptive regulation.
Certainly liability, we touch on liability in the report a little bit. Certainly liability, it has been an option that some people have proposed very seriously. The problem is that it has certain downsides. It makes innovators risk averse. And okay, then it may turn out to be that ultimately in the end we have to make that choice explicitly. We have to say, I mean, if the nation goes down this liability path, then we may be effectively saying, okay, we're willing to accept a slower pace of innovation in return for greater security. Maybe that's a good trade. That's the point. That's a public policy issue. We haven't yet come to the point where we're willing to acknowledge that trade-off. And, by the way, what about all the foreign competitors who are also going to innovate? And is there going to be a way of making them abide by the same rules? Well, that's going to be much harder.
You have been issuing cybersecurity reports for a long time.
That's true.
When did you start?
The first cybersecurity-related report that I did at the Academy came out in 1996, which was a study of the encryption problem, which was export controls on encryption and Clipper chip.
So you have... I have been reading your stuff on this constellation of subjects for a long time, and you're one of the people who can legitimately say you've been sounding, in a non-alarmist fashion, sounding the alarm for a very long time.
Yes.
What part of the message has the political system heard and responded to, and the market heard and responded to, and what part is just whistling past a graveyard? That's a bad analogy.
Well, that's fine. I get the point. Some of our message has been heard. That is, if you talk about cybersecurity now, the state of cybersecurity now, there are certain things that are different about it now than they were 20 years ago. There's more attention to it. There's more attention to it. Precious little action, but more attention to it. That's a good thing. More knowledge about cybersecurity has accumulated. So that means that if there is the political and economic will to implement solutions, there are more choices available. So that's a good thing. But fundamentally, your question is, why aren't we investing, and by investing, I don't just mean money, but time, energy, effort, money, and so on, into enhancing cybersecurity? I think that there are a variety of reasons for it, most of which having to do with the fact that we want cybersecurity, but we want other things too. So part of our message that cybersecurity is important has come about. The part that hasn't come about is, and if you want to solve the problem, you have to take some action. And action has costs and downsides. And we haven't been yet willing to, as a nation, to incur the downsides of it.
Tell us about how you got into this work and how you define the scope of your work. I mean, I've read your stuff on, you know, bio threats, uh-huh. on cybersecurity, on all kinds of different areas related to the space of technology and security threats. How do you define the parameters of what you do, and how do you get into it?
Before I came to the academy, which was in 1990, I was a congressional staff member, professional staff member, and a staff scientist for the House Armed Services Committee. And I was there for 3.5 years or so. So I was steeped in a lot of security issues from the inside in that role. That was the end of about 10 years or so that I had spent doing strategic arms control and defense policy issues and so on. So I have a long history with the Cold War and so on. That's where I came out of it. So my perspective these days is informed by a history working with many of these issues. What particularly makes me suitable, I think, for understanding cybersecurity issues is that I have experience as a hacker. In high school, I was a hacker.
What sort
and,
of?
So well, but people, I was a, but yes.
People mean different things
yes,
by
that's
hackers.
Correct.
What
that's
kind
correct.
Of hacker were you?
That's correct. First of all, the first thing I have to say there is back in those days, it wasn't illegal.
Right, and any statute of limitations has run.
That's right. But the people that I knew who were hacking and so on at that time are the kinds of people that the laws were passed to stop.
Okay. So when was this?
This was in late 60s and early 70s. And I also went to a school, college at MIT, which valued hacking. And it's an element of the culture there. And back in those days, the term hacker meant somebody who had some degree of skill in unraveling technical systems and in understanding them. It was an honorable title back then. Now, of course, it has become a pejorative thing. And the people who are the hackers of my generation, they often refer to the bad guy hackers now as crackers. As people who hack for evil reasons and so on. Back in my day, it was the thrill of the challenge and trying to understand computer systems and so on. And there was a kind of symbiotic relationship between the hacker community and the people who were trying to build more secure computer systems then, because we challenged each other.
So what kind of stuff did you do?
There were systems at MIT which had elementary security systems built into it that I took a certain amount of joy in circumventing. I mean, as an example.
And to what extent was any of it destructive versus
zero?
So it
zero.
Was, it was simply, can you get in?
That's correct. It wasn't destructive at all. Any of the hacking that I stopped doing it after a couple of years at MIT.
And so what's the trajectory? I mean, there are a lot of ex-hackers, including some reformed ex-kind of black hat hackers mm-hmm. who now do security mm-hmm. stuff. What was your trajectory from being a kind of recreational, experimental hacker to, you know, convening panels of scientists to think about how to make internet architecture, communications architecture more secure?
Well, as I say, I gave up hacking in the early 70s, really. But I never stopped being interested in the topic, and I kept my hand in it in the sense of reading about it and so on for many years thereafter. When I had moved into doing national security work, I didn't touch computers at that time. Computers were not on the radar as a seriously on the radar as a national security threat. Sometimes there were some reports about it, and I would follow them and so on. But it was it was 3% of my activity. When the Soviet Union fell, I made a political judgment to myself. I said, I've been doing security studies now for 10 years. Soviet Union is gone. There's no more future in doing security studies, national security studies. That's not going to be interesting anymore. And so I left and did something else, and I went to the academies. Boy, was I wrong. there are, of course, many more security issues in this post-Cold War era now. And the magnitude of my wrongness was breathtaking. Okay. But it became pretty clear that very few people doing information technology and public policy, at least in the academy context and so on, in sort of the traditional IT and policy at that particular interface, knew anything at all about cybersecurity. Knew anything at all about national security issues. And when cybersecurity started becoming an important part of the world, of this new world, I thought there was an interesting niche to fill.
And when you think about the major cybersecurity issues, with the sort of constellation and hierarchy of them, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, people talk about a cyber Pearl Harbor. There's clearly quite routine cyber exploitation of all sorts of government and private sector stuff. And there's a whole lot of cyber street crime, identity thefts and data exploitations.
Right.
What is it that kind of keeps you up at night in when you have your cyber nightmares?
I do worry about catastrophic cyber events that would, as they say, bring the nation to its knees. I am, in some sense, more concerned about nuclear events that might bring the nation to its knees. And just as one example of that, a nuclear weapon going off anywhere in the world, let alone on U.S. soil, that killed nobody, let alone 100,000 people, would change our environment, our domestic environment, I think, completely. And of course, if it went off in the Nevada desert now, and it wasn't a U.S. it wasn't a U.S. test, but rather some bad guy who detonated a nuclear weapon, the way Bill Perry, former Secretary of Defense, puts it is, the United States would not be the same country afterwards, even if nobody were killed. I mean, can you imagine the enormous political reaction to that in terms of what we would be doing to secure our nation against that sort of thing? And this is true regardless of how big the nuclear weapon is, right? It could be a 1 kiloton weapon versus a 10 kiloton weapon versus a 100 kiloton weapon in the context that I described that killed nobody. I mean, that would matter. That difference wouldn't matter at all. That would be the fact that there was a nuke that went off. One of the interesting things about this, of course, is that you realize that there's no such thing as a small nuclear explosion, at least not in political terms. Politically, there's no such thing as a small nuclear explosion. Of course, we suffer cyber attacks, myriad cyber attacks every day, and the nation goes on. In fact, it's oblivious to it, more or less. I mean, I complain about that a lot, as you know. So I have to say, I worry in some sense, in terms of consequences of the nation, the nuclear stuff worries me a lot more as a citizen, as a person who follows all this stuff. Nonetheless, I mean, do I worry about cyber catastrophes? Sure. An example of a cyber catastrophe that everybody talks about is the cyber security, is a cyber attack on the grid, the electric grid, which will bring everything down. That's the fear. But if you analyze the most significant concerns to the security of the grid, or at least the ones, the scenarios that people talk about most. They usually involve the destruction by using cyber means of components that are essential to the grid, like big transformers and the like, that have a long lead time production and for which there are no easy replacements. So it'll take 6 months, it'll take 9 months to get a new one, one of these transformers that weigh 1,000 tons, that kind of thing. And we don't have any spares for them. I mean, that's the argument. And so you say, this is bad. You could imagine a scenario. It's very difficult, by the way, to create such a scenario. But can you do it? Sure. Well, sure, we don't know. At least that's the worry. Okay, it's very, very hard to do it. Because you have to bypass safeties in certain ways that are very complicated. Sometimes they involve manual switching, and you'd have to find one that was whether you knew somehow that the safeties were disabled and, you know, that kind of thing, which sometimes happens. And your cyber attack gets you into the control system, and you manipulate current flows, and then they all converge onto the same transformer, and it explodes. That's the fear. Okay, fair enough. That's a reasonable fear. But it also turns out that these guys are vulnerable sitting out in the open, and they are vulnerable to rocket-propelled grenades or even high-powered hunting rifles. And there are no walls around these things. There are no dogs guarding them. And you could easily do damage, significant damage, long-lasting damage to one of these things from a physical attack on it. So would it be better if we fix the cyber vulnerabilities that would enable this sort of attack? Sure, that would be much better. This would be a better world. Would we be a lot safer? Would I sleep a lot better at night? No, I would not.
So if you say that the truly catastrophic attack is improbable, not because it's impossible, but because it's actually easier to do by non-cyber means.
In this particular case, yeah, that's right.
Then maybe the political system is not crazy for ignoring cyber threats on the following theory. Yes, we get attacked all the time, and despite that, the internet is flourishing. Commerce on the internet is flourishing. The costs are clearly manageable. Yes, some stuff is getting stolen. That's unfortunate, but companies can improve their security to the extent that they are able and willing to invest in that. And there actually is no terrible problem here, except that there's a certain drainage from of wealth that would happen in any context where you're, where lots of people of, you know, different countries are interacting. Some are going to steal from each other, and that's just going to happen. What's the huge problem here if you take the catastrophic stuff off the table?
Well, partly it depends on what you mean by catastrophic. For example, if I use cyber means to, in an attack on U.S. military forces, and I didn't destroy battleships going out there. I know we don't have battleships, like aircraft carriers or sink them or something. And I didn't cause planes to fall out of the ground. But I just screwed around with their deployment schedule and their deployments in such a way that they arrived, that they were unable to deploy on time. That by on time is that they might be delayed 3 or 4 days in getting to their destination. I mean, that could happen. In any sort of major conflict, we'd mobilize our forces, we'd move forces quickly, and so on. So you say, well, you're just delaying them 3 or 4 days. That's a significant factor, right? 4 days is a significant factor. And of course, 4 days is just a random number. I don't have any inside information on this. 4 days could mean the difference between being irrelevant or being important to the resolution of a particular crisis on terms favorable to the U.S. Right? They could be there, and we're not. We have a much bigger fleet and so on, but they're there, and we're not. Or we're there, but we don't have the right ammunition or what have you. Now, is that a catastrophe? Well, depends on who you are, right? The from whose perspective are you talking? No American lives are lost in this, but I would argue that the U.S. suffers immensely from this.
What institutions are dealing with this well?
You mean with the cybersecurity problem?
Yeah. There's got to be somebody out there who's dealing with it well. Are other countries handling it well? Are institutions within the United States outperforming their peers?
I don't know the answer to that question. That's a very interesting question, and it would be interesting to find, for example, a U.S. government agency that one would say they deserve an A-plus for everything that they're doing well.
Or even, an A-.
Right, right. That would be interesting. Okay, and there are various. They may be some agencies that actually do that and that actually achieve such a grade. I think the GAO sometimes grades these guys, and then there are various private organizations that grade public organizations for cybersecurity capability and so on. But I certainly couldn't point to one and say that Department X is really good at this. I don't know of one.
When we talk about cybersecurity, the mental malefactor that we've always sort of created is the People's Liberation Army. In your perception, has China done a better job on the defensive side than? I mean, is their security good, or is this just an area where it's easy to be on offense, and so they're good at attacking us, but they're no better at defending against us than we are against them?
I don't know of any evidence to suggest that the cyber defensive posture of China is any better than that of the United States, and if I had to bet, I would think that it's much worse.
That's interesting.
And part of the reason is that we advertise our cyber weakness on the front page of the New York Times, right? You don't get the Chinese doing this. Chinese don't say we're weak. That our cyberspace is weak. And so, they complain that they're the victim a lot, but they don't advertise what their vulnerabilities are. They don't call attention to it over and over and over and over again.
And is that, are you praising them for that or criticizing them for that?
It's just a fact. I don't. But the point is that as a result of that, we don't have a clear understanding of what the Chinese are like. I mean, the Chinese are still running unpatched, pirated copies of Windows XP.
Right.
How secure can that be? That's right.
So you are leaving the National Academy.
Yes.
Tell us about the next great adventure.
In January, perhaps sooner, but in January at the latest, I'm assuming a position at Stanford University with a joint appointment between Stanford's Center for International Security and Cooperation and the Hoover Institution. My job is going to be to set up an academic research and education organization that's focused on cyber policy and security, task one in there is trying to figure out how academic research can couple to policy in an effective way.
Thanks for joining us.
Okay, glad to be here.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan. As always, please do us a solid and help to spread the word about Lawfare in any way you can. We're grateful for the support. Thanks very much for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.